to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Greta Anderson. Today we celebrate Black History Month by looking at the stories of the Martin family, one of the first African American families in Ames, and certainly one that left a mark on our history. We will be talking with Mary Martin Carr and Pauline Martin, granddaughters of Archie and Nancy Martin, who were born into slavery and started their new life in Ames around 1915, when they were both in their 60s. We also speak with Dennis Wendell, collections curator at Ames Historical Society, and Terry Adams, a fourth-generation Ames resident and one who remembers the Martin family with great fondness. Piano music was often heard at the Archie and Nancy Martin residence. The ISU students who boarded there often played the piano, not jazz music, says granddaughter Pauline. It was usually classical. We start our program with the recollections of sisters Mary and Pauline about their grandparents, Archie and Nancy Martin. I am here with Mary Martin Carr. Nice to meet you, Mary.
And nice to meet you, Greta.
Your family has a very rich history in Ames. Let's start with your grandparents, Archie and Nancy Martin, who brought their family here to Ames in, was it 1915?
1913, 1915, we're not exactly sure.
What were the circumstances that brought them to Ames?
My grandmother came to cook for the first woman doctor, whose husband was also a doctor in Ames. Their names were Dr. Jenny and Dr. David Grist, G-H-R-I-S-T.
Now, how did that connection come about?
Well, they must have been in Georgia and enjoyed some of my grandmother's cuisine.
Archie and Nancy built a house. In 1918, they built a house at 218 Lincoln Way.
Yes.
And why don't you tell the story about how that changed their lives and brought them a new role in the community?
Well, three of their sons, Archie Jr., Paul, my dad, and Robert or Bob, who was there next to the youngest son, helped them build that house. Their sons did. My grandparents took in college students who were unable to get housing in Ames, Black college students. And then at some point, my aunt, their daughter, Mrs. John Shipp, Nellie Shipp, had some of the women boarded with her, and they only lived within a block of each other.
I also got a chance to record a conversation with Pauline Martin, Mary's older sister, who has lived in Ames her entire life. Here's her story about her grandparents.
They moved from Marietta, Georgia, because this doctor team from Ames persuaded them that, you know, they might make a good living up here. My grandmother came and worked as a cook. So she went to work at, I can't tell you their fraternity, but she was a cook there. And my grandfather worked for the Northwestern Railroad. They were almost 60 when they moved here, because my grandfather was born in 1857 and grandma in 1856. So they worked for a few years, and their sons helped them build that house at 218 Lincoln Way. And it's a huge house. As kids, we spent a lot of time there on the front porch watching all the traffic go by. It had five bedrooms, huge basement, and there was living area down there, but I don't think anybody ever lived there. At the time, African-American students weren't allowed to live on campus unless they had an African-American roommate. And that didn't happen very often. And I even understand that George Washington Carver lived in a basement room on campus. And my grandfather went to the president and complained that, you know, that they needed housing. And they said they'd work on it. But in the meantime, they had this huge house. All their children were adults and living on their own by now. So they decided to take in African-American students, give them a place to live and some encouragement. And the house had 5 bedrooms, and 3 of them were kind of like a dormitory up on the second floor, and that's mainly where the students lived. They probably had maybe 4 to 6 students at any one time, and this over a span of, well, in the 30s and 40s. And we weren't allowed to go over there and bother the students. You know, my folks believed in children are to be seen and not heard. And the thing that amazes me is that most of those students, almost without exception, earned their PhDs. One of them, Samuel Massey, was considered one of the 75 top scientists in the world, and he worked on the Manhattan Project. And I think he died just within the last 10 years or so. And one of them was a Tuskegee Airman. He lives in Des Moines and was the school superintendent there for a while. They were a good influence. They believed that education was the way, you know, that was the only way to succeed. So people who lived there knew that they either studied and did what they were supposed to do or they could go someplace else. And they told us the same thing. You know, you need your education. That's the only way you're going to make anything of yourself. The porch on that house is huge. It goes the full length of the house. And it had the big pillars and the big banisters. And we could just sit out there for hours and watch cars go by. And back then, I think there was a gas station on 3 of the 4 corners. There was a big concession stand that was shaped like a coffee pot. And I remember grandmother used to go over there and buy root beer for us. My grandmother, she was a feisty little lady. And she was very skinny and wiry. And I remember she wore these stockings that never seemed to be smooth. They were always kind of baggy around her ankles. And she wore these soft-soled slippers that, you know, kind of shuffled when she walked because she, you know, because she was older. And my grandfather was just the opposite. He was just a really gentle man, always smiled, never heard him say a bad word or an unkind word, and he loved kids. In fact, he would sit in the backyard, and Lincoln School was right across the alley behind their house, and he could watch the kids playing at recess over there and always had a smile and a good word. But I think my grandmother had to be tough because they were born into slavery and they saw a lot of bad stuff. I mean, people were always being lynched and mistreated, and they had to protect their children, and, you know, they had to be the strong ones. So I think that's why she was that way. She had 4 children by her first marriage and 8 with Archie, and some of them didn't survive. But she was a tough lady. I mean, she could reprimand you in a hurry, but they were a pair. I think she died in 1947. I think she was 91, and my grandfather died in 61, and he was almost 103.
So she was a little older than he was.
Yeah, she was. She was.
Among the collections at the Ames Historical Society is a thick binder on the Martin family, as well as several artifacts. Dennis Wendell, the collection's curator, showed me a large crystal platter and punch bowl that Esther Martin, the mother of Mary and Pauline, bought at Carr's Hardware on Main Street and used for special occasions such as Christmas. The family has also generously donated a medal earned by Paul Martin, father of Mary and Pauline, when he served as a musician in World War I. The French bestowed this medal, called the Croix de Guerre, upon many African-American units who served with courage and fortitude with their armies, as so-called colored troops were barred from serving with white American troops. Finally, there is a remarkable document, a letter from Paul's white commanding officer to others who had been responsible for allowing bigots to treat the black men in his band disgracefully. Pauline told me that her father had a special fondness for the French national anthem. So let's listen to that as we explore the sisters' recollections of Paul Martin and his stories.
My sister Pauline really started our relationship with them. She donated a punch set of our mother's. And then she and I took stuff up, pictures and different things.
The medal that your father had earned while in the army?
Well, it was something the French gave to the black troops because they weren't allowed to train with guns or carry guns or fight with the white Americans. They fought with the French. You know, I remember him talking about how cold and wet it was. They went over in 1918 during a big flu epidemic when many people died. And there were no medicines, probably aspirin and whiskey. And he said that's what got them through on the boats and in the cold and the wet. My dad was born in 1894. So he would have been about 22. He was a musician. They entertained troops and different things. And Dennis did have one of the researchers say they got some stuff about the group Dad played with. His name was on the roster. And whoever was in charge of them, of course, was white. But he complained about the way they addressed the black soldiers.
Dennis Wendell, Collections Curator at Ames Historical Society. We're here perusing the file of the Martin family, and specifically Paul Martin, father of Mary, Pauline, and others that I knew. And a most unique document has surfaced, courtesy of a classmate and colleague of mine, Carol Cummings. And she unearthed this document from the archives of World War I. This individual was quite unique for the era, 1918, and he really objected to the stereotypes and the humor that was going around.
Can you quote from the letter there?
At the musical comedy entitled The Pink Stocking, given at the Opera House in Nantes, France, a monologue was given by Lieutenant Fulton from Louisiana, which was very much disliked by myself and the colored men of my orchestra and command. I do not care to have my band and myself ordered to entertain such theatricals where unjust critics such as Lieutenant Fulton are allowed to speak and amuse themselves by jesting and censoring the colored race. These men are soldiers of the United States and of the AEF, American Expeditionary Force, and these men are not to be spoken of as, and there's the N-word, but as colored men and soldiers of USA. Explanation in full is requested or interview is desired. B.W. Cartwright, 1st Lieutenant, Infantry, USA Commanding. A very powerful letter for that era. How many officers would have had the guts to do this? I think it's just very, very, very special.
As I understand it, he had done some vaudeville. He could be a ham and tell some funny... But, you know, of course, when we were growing up, he was very busy supporting his family. We all wish we had asked more questions. Everybody was busy working. But I do remember Dad saying, growing up in the South, a couple of times he said he came close to being lynched for doing nothing. And the white families that he worked for protected him. I remember at some point in my public school education, he filled out some form, some government form, and he put down for race, black American. And they sent it back to him and made him change it. Well, black wasn't the terminology then. So he was a man ahead of his time.
Yeah.
he was one of those fathers who all he only had to tell you something once. He never had to repeat himself if he did, watch out. He never had a high school education. I think he might have gone to, I don't know, sixth or eighth grade, I'm not sure. And he worked several jobs. He did custodial work, and he worked in a shoe shop on Main Street. And I remember they worked Collegiate Manufacturing Company, and sometimes we would go with them in the mornings to help clean. And it's a place where they cut all this felt for pennants and shirts and blankets and things. And seemed like hundreds of sewing machines and all of this stuff all over the floor, so we would sometimes go and help sweep up all that felt. And he rode a bicycle. We didn't have a car. He rode a bicycle to work. I remember that old bicycle. That's the way he got around. He finally bought a car, I think, in about the early 50s. But we had assigned jobs to do. My mother should never have had to lift her finger because she had six daughters. We had, you know, things to do. And if they weren't done when Dad got home, we paid for it. We had all of these lilac bushes along the south side of the house. And boy, that's where the switches came from. We knew that we had to be responsible, and he said, and don't you ever disgrace me by doing anything wrong. You know, he was a strong-willed man. I mean, when he said something, he meant it. Now, my mother, she would say, you wait till your dad gets home, but then she'd forget by the time he got home. He served in World War I. He was in a band. They went to France, and he was in a band over there. He played by ear. I don't know how he could be in a band and not read music, but he did. Some things he told me, I thought, Dad, is that really true, or did you just make that up? Like, he said, when they came back from France at the end of the war, he said there were 90 lynchings in the South. You know, make sure that these guys who came back didn't get out of their place. And there's that song a black singer recorded, something about strange fruit.
Yes.
About the bodies hanging in the trees. And anyway, he said that there was a rash of lynchings to make sure that none of these guys would get out of hand. And one story he told over and over again, and I could never decide if it was true or not, he said there was a place a place called Laughing Barrel, Mississippi, that if any black person wanted to laugh, they had to go stick their head in that barrel, you know, and laugh. They couldn't do it. And I thought, Dad, I don't know about this.
Did he meet your mother before the war or after?
I think after. I think they were married in 1928. And we don't have any wedding pictures. I mean, it was a double wedding. The twins and the brothers. And there's no record in history about that. And that really, that would have been an event.
What Paul told Pauline was right. There was a rash of lynchings in the South the summer after Armistice Day. At least 10 of these were former servicemen who had experienced much more humane treatment by the French. However, there is no town known as Laughing Barrel, Mississippi, but there is a folk legend that dates back to slavery regarding the Laughing Barrel. Plantation slaves could receive severe punishment for laughing, so that whenever a situation or a story humored them to the point of bursting, they would rush to a barrel and let loose. Of course, in the Jim Crow South, it was not much different, as even looking at a person the wrong way could cause a black man bodily harm at the hands of mobs. The musician Big Bill Brunsey, born around the same time as Paul Martin, responded to such injustices in song. Interestingly enough, this prolific songwriter and performer had a history in Ames as well. Big Bill Brunsey is a story for another day, but let's listen to one of his original songs, When Do I Get to Be Called a Man?
When I was born into this world, this is what happened to me. I was never called a man in around 53. I wonder when will I get to be called a man and try to wait like in 93. When Uncle Sam called me, I knew I'd be called a real McCoy. And I got an army that has called me Soldier Boy. I'm on the win. I'm on the win. I'm on the win. Will I get to be called a man? Do I have to wait till I get 93? When I got back from overseas, that night we had a ball. Next day I met the old boss. He said, boy, get you some overhauls. I wonder when. I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man. I do have to wait till I get 93. I worked on 11 counts and extra games too. Black man's a boy, I don't care what he can do. I wonder when. I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man. Do I have to wait till I get 93? They said I was uneducated, my clothes was dirty and torn. Now I've got a little education, but I'm still a boy right on. I wonder when. I wonder when. I wonder when will I get to be called a man. Do I have to wait till I get 93?
This is Local Talk. We are talking about the Martin family, an African-American family that has been honored by both the City of Ames and the University. I asked sisters Pauline and Mary to describe their Ames neighborhood growing up in the 1940s and 50s and the types of racism they encountered back then.
My mother and her identical twin sister married brothers. They married two of the Martin brothers. So we're kind of an extended family, double cousins, and we always lived within walking distance of each other. My parents would reprimand them, and they'd do the same with us. We lived on the corner of Washington and South 3rd Streets. South 3rd is now a major thoroughfare. It's a four-lane street. It was a cinder road when we moved there, when my parents bought that property on the corner. We lived in a four-room house, and we called it the Little Yellow House because it was yellow. And it had a kitchen, a dining room, a living room, and one bedroom. When my youngest sister was born, that was 10 of us living in that four-room house. And Dad got a permit to build just before the war ended in 45, and he built a two-story, four-bedroom house. But when we first moved there, there was a dairy farm in our backyard. You know, our backyard was up against, it was called the Guernsey Farm, and it's down at the south end of Kellogg and South 3rd. And they had cows and a dairy.
So where the party store is?
Yes.
The rental store.
All of that from the back of our yard down to maybe halfway to Duff was a dairy farm. Guernsey cows would come up and graze up by the fence, and sometimes the bull would get loose and everybody would run for the house. And there was a huge hill that we called the Guernsey Hill, and we would go down there with skis and sleds in the wintertime. It was great fun. Now it's all apartment houses back in there. You know, we knew our neighbors because it was a close-knit neighborhood, and some of my brothers and maybe one of my sisters were paper carriers, so they knew all the people. And we went to a neighborhood school. Lincoln School was where the Human Resources Building is now. And our church was right across from the school. It was the Evangelical United Brethren Church. Now it's the Nazarene Church. We were close enough to walk everywhere.
Strong family unit between my parents and my siblings, our aunts and uncles and cousins. And in our neighborhood, we knew that many of our neighbors were bigots. But we also had many wonderful neighbors. And the bigots, we lived peacefully together. But there were times when skating up and down our block or riding our bikes or a few, we got called racial names sometimes. My mother would not get into arguments with people. And she just said, my kids aren't used to being called those names or whatever. And one of the families that did some of the most name-calling, our families became very fast friends all the time. And you know, we were friendly with one of the women in our neighborhood who was, we knew they were bigoted. And I, when I came back to Ames in 75, I was in a Bible study. And this lady said, Mary, we like your family, we know you, but these other people that are coming to town, well, you know, anybody, if you don't know people, you get to know them before you decide friendships and so forth. And you can't decide character by the color of someone's skin.
Beginning, there were only two or three, maybe, African-American families?
In my grade school years, there were the Lowrys. They had a tailoring business, and they lived up near the hospital. There were some Kellys. There were Rena and Cliff Smith, and their son, Jack, graduated from Ames High in, I think, about 1936. And, you know, our parents knew each other and were friends. The men cut each other's hair, and my dad cut my brother's. I can remember people coming, they'd go down in the basement, and Dad would cut their hair, or he'd go over to their house, and they'd cut his. And, you know, it was a cohesive, supportive group of people.
Geography teacher in seventh grade. And I think every time an African American was in her class, she had to discuss nigger toes. You know, that's another name for Brazil nuts. You've never heard that?
No.
Every time one of us was in her class, then she had to discuss nigger toes. And and we also had a teacher, I think he taught government. And one of my cousins dated a girl in my sister Ruth's class, and she was white. I mean, it wasn't really a date. They just went out this one time. And this government teacher, he had to tell every class that this girl was ruined or spoiled or something because she had gone out with my cousin. And, you know, it was things like that. And then another teacher, our mother died in 1961, just a few days after my youngest sister had started her senior year in high school. And she was in this teacher's homeroom. And when she came back, the first thing he said to her was, well, I guess you'll have to drop out of school and go to work and help your father support your family. You know, and what a mean, callous thing to say. She was devastated because our mother died in her sleep. She was 54.
My father worked very hard and took very good care of his children. We knew we better behave. We were well fed. My father worked in the shoe shop during the day, shining shoes, because his primary source of income, he cleaned buildings. And at night, in early morning hours, was when he did his primary work. My dad cleaned several businesses. They did the Collegiate Manufacturing Company. They did the gas company. They did some insurance offices, Red Cross. I mean, they worked hard. They supported their family. My dad was an industrious person. During the day, he wasn't sitting around. He worked in the shoe shop. In later years, he went out to work at Iowa State as a custodian.
I'm glad I didn't have to grow up in the South. And, you know, things that happened to Mary, I think if they had happened to me, I would be an introvert. I'd be a hermit. I would be totally isolated. But, you know, I don't know what happened to me. I didn't get any of the spunk and the aggressiveness that my sisters have. I mean, they stand up for themselves. And me, I will run from a fight. I don't want to, you know, I just don't like conflict. I remember when I was in high school, I think I was maybe 15, and two of my friends, my classmates, invited me to join Rainbow, Eastern Star.
Is it a Mason organization?
Yes.
Okay.
And my mother said, I don't think this is a good idea. And I think it was $3 for membership or something. She said, I don't think this is a good idea. And I wanted to belong to something. She gave me the $3. And my mother got this note from the organization saying that they were sure I was, a very nice person, but I wouldn't be accepted at this time or something. And anyway, what hurt was that the two friends, Marilyn and Chloe. Chloe was really upset. She really felt badly about it. But Marilyn, oh man, she twisted the knife. She gloated about it, that I was blackballed, And it really hurt. And I thought, boy, I'm never going to let anybody do that to me again. And let's see, Mary is 7 years younger than I am. A few years later, Mary's classmate, Joe Boston, was accepted into Rainbow. So they changed. But boy, and there wasn't much of a social life in Ames for African Americans. I, for one, am not one. I don't make friends easily. I decide I'm not going to let anybody hurt my feelings anymore. Even later than that, in my own church, I taught Sunday school for probably 25 years at Calvary. And one Christmas, we were working with the kids in the sanctuary on the Christmas program. And, we had all taught for some time, and we were working, doing the program, and one of these teachers referred to me as what's-her-name. And I mean, here we're Sunday school teachers, we've worked together, we've planned lessons together, and she couldn't, and I wasn't good enough for her to remember my name. And two of my sisters, Mary and Ruth, are both registered nurses. Well, they're both retired, but they dealt with people, and they knew how to handle themselves. And they knew how to stand up for themselves, but I just decided I'm going to stay out of it. I'm not going to put myself in a position to where I get hurt.
My sister worked for the DOT for 41 years. She is a very quiet, focused person who wouldn't cause a ripple if her life depended on it. She worked with some wonderful people. But, for her to get a little up in grade or a little pay increase, she had to test and fight for it. I'll say test and wait for it, where other people got it without testing. When I was in Texas, this doctor, whom I didn't care for, had referred to me as Sunshine. And I didn't say anything, but I made up my mind if he said it again, I was going to. And so some woman referred to me as Sunshine, and I said, please don't call me that. And she said, well, I call my daughter that all the time. And I said, I'm not your daughter. I said, well, you're lucky you didn't say that to my mother. Call people by their name. And if you don't know their name, introduce yourself. But to call a person of color Sunshine is derogatory. There are a lot of ways of bigotry. I think of one time when we went to Clear Lake to a meeting, and we were assigned somebody to share a room with. And the person they paired me with, it was interesting. We were in bed, and I said something to her, and she said, please don't talk to me when I'm in bed or when I'm trying to sleep. And I'm sure that she was offended at having been paired with me, because it was pretty obvious. But you know what? That wasn't a big thing. It was one or two nights. We were there for a meeting. We shared a room to sleep and get dressed. We went to our meetings. We ate in other places. I can handle it. Everybody can't. My dearest, longest friend is Colleen, and our families were friends. And the first week of kindergarten, she and her mother came to get me to play. And my folks had just built a new house. It was the end of World War II, 1944-45. So anyway, the first week of school or so, her mother came and they knocked on the door, and I can see my mother. And I was upstairs, and she told me they wanted to know if I wanted to go play, so I went to play. My first experience, I was listening to a program, and they said, "When did you first know you were black?" And I thought about that. And I thought, well, it must have been in first grade when a new girl came. And we sat across from each other. Her name was Carol. We wanted to be friends, but her parents did not want her to be friends with me. And she spoke of this, and I said, well, you're not white and I'm not black because you'd be the color of this paper. Anyway, one time we were playing outside our house in the yard with dolls. Carol had told her mother she was going to go play with Mary Jo. And Colleen was playing with Mary Jo. They went to ask Carol's mother if they could borrow Carol's bike. And her mother said, well, isn't Carol playing with you? No, she's at Mary Martin's. Busted. Mary Jo came and told Carol she had to go home. And Carol got grounded for 2 weeks. Another time we were going to go to the high school on a Saturday morning to see Aladdin. So I went down to Mary Jo's to meet them. And here came Carol and her mother. They went in the house. I'm out on this big front porch. And I had been in Mary Jo's house before. So Carol and her mother came and went in. And then Mary Jo came out stubbing her toe on the porch and said, Carol can't go. And I said, it's because I'm going, isn't it? And she didn't say anything, so I went home. Oh. Well, but you know, I handled it, but I remember it. I can visualize it. And Mary Jo, I've seen in intervening years, and I mentioned this to her, and of course she didn't remember it. And Colleen didn't either, but it happened to me, so I remember it. I had a friend, Alicia, and a friend, Patricia, as well as Colleen, but Colleen was the closest. I went to birthday parties. I played at their house. Their mothers knew my mother. In grade school, if I got in a tiff with Colleen, everybody was on her side. She doesn't remember that either, but we were out in the playground, and Patricia said hi in to me. She couldn't bring herself to say the word, but she said hi in and kept going. And you know what? I remember it, but I did not hold it against her. And she died a couple of years ago. She and her kids had moved back to Ames, and I was able to be supportive to her and to them, as were some of our other classmates. Alicia was also. So was Colleen, that little foursome. And real friendships withstand things. You know, she couldn't bring herself to say it. She knew it was wrong. And I kind of mentioned that to her, too. And, of course, she wouldn't remember that either.
This is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. You are listening to Local Talk. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and today we are celebrating Black History Month by talking about the Martin family of Ames. Archie and Nancy Martin moved from Georgia in around 1915, built a home on Lincoln Way in 1918, then opened their home to African American students at ISU who could not find housing on campus. In the past decade or so, this work has been commemorated in various ways. In 2002, a brick pillar or pier was dedicated to them in downtown Ames, and in 2004, a new residence hall on the ISU campus was christened Martin Hall. We'll hear granddaughter Pauline's description of this process, then turn to Ames resident Terry Adams, who she credits for having an important role.
Well, about the time that the city started having these piers on Main Street and around the downtown area, one of our local people, Terry Adams, who used to own Adams Funeral Home, he noted all of the piers that were being dedicated, and he said, "Now, why isn't there one for the Martins?" And that's when we started our Martin Foundation. That must have been 2000 or 2001. And he said, the piers are not completed until we have one for Archie and Nancy. So that's how that got started. And in the meantime, I thought, you know, some of those piers are duplicates. I mean, like there are two for the DOT and two for the Dinky and two for something else. And I thought, why didn't they, you know, the Adams families and the McFarlands, why aren't they represented there? I mean, they were big contributors to the community, but I don't know who made the decision. But anyway, the pier went through, I kind of think we raised some money, and then some of it was a grant from the city. And so in 2002, the pier was dedicated, and it was a great occasion. And it's on the corner of 5th and Burnett.
Was the foundation instrumental in
getting the pier done?
What about the dedication of the
residence hall? I think Tom Hill had a lot to do with that.
He's the Vice President of Student Affairs?
I think so. And we worked together with him, the foundation, and they thought, well, Archie and Nancy had essentially opened up a residence hall of their own, so they wanted to honor them for that. And I think Tom Hill had a lot to do with it, but it was collaborative.
It was quite an honor.
It was. And like Tom said at the dedication, they didn't just pick an old building and then slap their name on it. This was a brand new $23 million state-of-the-art building. It's beautiful. And I remember in the living room, in the corner of the living room of my grandparents' house, was this upright piano, and the students would play that. And the funny thing is they didn't play jazz. Well, I never heard them play jazz or contemporary stuff. It was always somebody playing classical music. And so that was one of the things that our foundation wanted to do. We bought a piano and had it installed in the hall out there. It was quite an honor. And I can't help thinking that my dad would have been so pleased, you know, that something like this would happen to honor them like that.
This is Greta Anderson from Local Talk. I'm here with Terry Adams of the Adams family, a long-standing family in Ames. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your family dates back how far?
In Ames?
In Ames.
My great-grandparents, Benjamin Franklin and Rebecca Evans Adams, came here in the spring of 1869. And we've been pretty much here ever since. That was, I think, 4 years after Ames was officially a town.
How long has the business, the funeral home there on 5th and Douglas? I know that it no longer is in your family, but when did it get started?
Back in the early days, there was furniture and undertaking combined businesses, and they were on Main Street. And in 1899, my grandfather, who had been in grocery business with his brother, bought Elliott Furniture and Undertaking, and it became Adams Furniture and Undertaking. And then in 1924, the building on 5th and Douglas, the old Greeley home, this went for sale. So we've had the building since 1924, the business since 1899. I never lived there, but my grandparents did when he bought it, and we would have family gatherings there for holidays. I went to State University of Iowa for 4 years and came back. Well, when I got out of the military, I thought, well, I better consider what I want to do for a living. I ended up going to mortuary science school up in Minnesota, came back and worked for the funeral home, and then I bought it from my father and my uncle.
What did you like about doing that line of work?
Well, nice to be relied upon. I like helping people in their time of need.
You must have really gotten to know the families in Ames very well through that work.
Being a fourth-generation Adams family here in Ames, been around for a while, we kind of get to know Ames and a lot of the people pretty well.
Well, I brought you here to ask you about a family in Ames, one of the first or most prominent African-American families, the Martin family. Were you aware of the Martin family growing up?
Yes, I was. One reason is my mother had a couple of aunts and uncles who lived on the same block on Lincoln Way that the Archie Martin did. And we would go visit them, and one time my dad just walked me down the street and pointed out Archie's house and then told me about him. However, I knew his daughter before that, Nellie Shipp. My mother had hired her to come and help with her work at home, cleaning the house and doing ironing and so forth. And Nellie Shipp did a good job. Nell had a son, Grant Shipp. And I remember one time Nellie Shipp took Grant and me, and we walked through Brookside Park together, got to know her very well. And then in 1950, I went to the Boy Scout Jamboree in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and our senior patrol leader was a son of Archie's, Freddie Martin. I shouldn't say Freddie anymore because he's Dr. Frederick. He's a retired dentist over in Pennsylvania now. But he was our senior patrol leader and got to know him a little bit. At least I knew who he was. My dad, of course, knew the family.
How do you think the Martin family got along? Do you think Ames was a welcoming place for them, or do you think that they faced some barriers?
Well, I don't know if the Martin family specifically faced barriers, but I do know that Archie, when he built that house, had the second floor, and as African-American students would come to Iowa State back in those days, couldn't get any housing anywhere, he would make sure they were put up. He had a place for them to stay while they were students here, which I thought indicates that there was some division in Ames at that time. Don't think that's the case anymore, but I just remember my folks early on saying, there are people, that's it, you don't classify. So parents raised me the right way in that situation. And of course, the fact that Nell Shipp worked my mother early on made me get to know him better than might be the case otherwise. Then when somebody wanted to get going and recognize the Martin family, I was happy to be part of that group because I've known some of the family for quite a while and known some of them pretty well. And it was a real pleasure getting to do more research. I found it very interesting that in the Martin family, Archie Martin and one of his sons and his daughter, Nell Shipp, all lived to be over 100 before they died. Now, Archie's wife died young. She was in her mid-90s. That's unusual for anybody at any time, and to consider situation back then, I think it was really unusual, but it was a real pleasure to know them.
So Pauline told me that Ames was making these piers, these brick piers that were commemorating significant figures in Ames history, and it was your idea to make one commemorating Archie and Nancy Martin. Is that true?
Well, I don't know that it was my idea as such. There were some of us that got onto that and got together right away. And that's when I went back to the funeral home, got my records out so I could find out everything I could about the Martins and make it very complete. Of course, I do have a photograph at my home in my one of my scrapbooks here of the dedication of the Martin pillar when it was put in. So that was a special deal, knowing the family. And
at what point in their planning for these piers did your group advocate for that?
Oh, the piers had been in for a while when we came up with the Martin pier. It was a good group met there. I think we did some good work on that. Nice to have some variety coming in to kind of try different approaches on it.
You know that Pauline thinks there should be a pier for the Adams family.
I kind of thought that.
Maybe it would be good to have one right by the funeral home.
Well, that'd be a good location.
We'll have to work on that.
Yeah.
Did you serve the family in your profession as an undertaker?
Yes, I did. Well, all of the ships, I think, and the Martins would have been before I was into the business.
Were you aware of race making the job different in any way?
I didn't ever feel there was any big difference. They were just good family to know all the way.
One day I was at the Historical Society. Do you know who Terry Adams is? He was one of the original Martin Foundation people, and his family had Adams Funeral Home. My dad went hunting with his dad and some of those men a time or two, and we were in the Historical Society, and I was graduated in 58. Dennis Wendell was graduated in 59. We're standing in there singing the Ames High Fight song in the Central Iowa. And they said, how can you remember that? We loved Ames High. Enjoyed Central, and Lincoln is very dear to our heart. Students of Ames Senior High, proud of our school are we, cheering the orange and the black, on to the victory, rah, 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 comrades in work and in play, loyal and true are we, doing the best for our high school, Ames High, Ames High. I hope you weren't recording that.
Of course I was. That's going to be on the air. You betcha.
You know, I when we left junior high from ninth grade to go to Ames High, and we had our picnic and our final day's activities, some of our classmates had written a song. It was "So Long, Dear Central, the time to leave is here. No more will we wave your blue and gold so dear. For the last time, our voices will ring through your walls, and the last time has come that we'll walk through your halls. We'll never forget the friends that we've made, the teachers and classes and jokes that were played. We've had a swell 3 years, dear junior high, and now the time has come that we must say goodbye." You noticed I didn't sing it, but I remember the tune.
I like living in Ames. I think everything you need is right here in Ames. It's clean. There are a lot of things to do. We've got all the cultural things, and I like the following the sports. I just think it's one of the best places to live.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today we have been talking about the Martin family of Ames. We spoke with Mary Martin Carr and Pauline Martin, granddaughters of Archie and Nancy Martin. We also spoke with Terry Adams, fourth generation Ames resident and founding member of the Martin Foundation, and Dennis Wendell, collections curator at Ames Historical Society. We are indebted to the Ames Historical Society, our next door neighbors on Douglas Street, for their gracious assistance with this story. Their website is ameshistoricalsociety.org. Please visit them online or in person to share your own favorite story about Ames. I'm Greta Anderson, your host and the sole reporter for this show. Rick Morrison is the engineer. We heard Chopin's Waltz Opus 64, the U.S. Navy Band playing the French National Anthem, the Metropolitan Military Band playing the United Forces March, Sunny Side of the Street by Jack McVeigh, Albatross by Fleetwood Mac, Chopin's Largo in E-flat major, and of course, the Loyalty Song played by the Ames High Marching Band. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio